1.6 to 2.2. And that's not acceptable.
Ride it like a cowboy is yet another term I didn't think I would ever have to say on TV during my career. But here's the problem. There is no scientific or medical expert who told the president, as far as we know, to ride it like a cowboy. In fact, the president himself continuously brushed off the threat of coronavirus.
And we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
How concerned are you?
Well, we pretty much shut it down coming in from China.
We're finding very little problem, very little problem. Now, you treat this like a flu. When you have 15 people, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear. Some people will have this at a very light level and won't even go to a doctor or a hospital. They'll get better. There are many people like that.
The president also suggested that impeachment may have distracted him from paying as much attention to this as he would have liked. The impeachment was concluded on February the 5th. It was long after that, well into March, probably March 12th, before the president started taking this seriously.
In stage one, we say nothing is going to happen.
Stage two, we say something may be going to happen, but we should do nothing about it.
In stage three, we say that maybe we should do something about it, but there's nothing we can do.
Stage four, we say maybe there was something we could have done, but it's too late now.
What do you say to Americans who are upset with you over the way you downplayed this crisis over the last couple of months? We have it very much under control in this country. We're doing a great job with it. It will go away.
It will go away, and we're going to have a great victory. And it's people like you and CNN that say things like that, that it's why people just don't want to listen to CNN anymore. You could ask a normal question. The statements I made are, I want to keep the country calm. I don't want panic in the country. I could cause panic much better than even you. I could do much. I would make you look like a minor league player.
That's great. That was our president boasting about his ability to terrify us. Don't worry. We know you're really good at that. Okay. You don't have to brag. This kind of tells you all you need to know about how things are going at the White House. Trump showed off the new COVID-19 testing machine and he had it upside down. This is the 61 Divoc. I mean, COVID-19. It's also the way he's going to present his economic charts from here on. Look at this, straight up.
The president charting his own course, saying as recently as yesterday that, as we've reported, all this should be done by Easter.
We're thinking that around Easter, that's going to be your spike. That's going to be the highest point, we think. And then it's going to start coming down from there. That will be a day of celebration.
250 years ago, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, whose full name, you know, he was Jewish, so his full name might have been like Christowitz, but God rose him from the dead on a holiday we now call Easter. Not a lot of people know that, but it's called Easter. It's when Jesus and the two Corinthians met the Easter bunny and came back from the dead. It's a beautiful story. Very important for the Christians, like me. And I have decided, I'm announcing today, we are going to bring back the economy on Easter Sunday. Because God, who, to be honest, is, you know, he's a good God. He's done some strong things. Some, let's be honest, his record is like not so great, though. He brought one guy back on Easter Sunday. And it was his son, so it was kind of like biased, but we're going to bring back the entire economy on Easter Sunday. And at that point, I think basically I'm better than God. So when we do it, we're going to do it toughly. We're going to do it with great compassion, great strength, tremendous strength, and also toughness. Easter Sunday, we're going to put it on pay-per-view. God versus Trump. Who brings back more people on Easter Sunday? We're doing it. I'm going to fire Fauci probably on Good Friday. And they call it Great Friday for Trump. And that's it. So let's do it. Let's get perfect health. Let's get back to work. Jesus Christ, not as good as Trump.
Attention, everyone. Let's all give thanks to the leader for this glorious day.
The leader is good. The leader is great. We surrender our will as of the state.
The leader is good. The leader is great. We surrender our will as of the state.
Mike Pence, I don't think he sleeps anymore. These are people that should be appreciated. He calls all the governors. I tell him, I mean, I'm a different type of person. I say, Mike, don't call the governor of Washington. You're wasting your time with him.
Here in Washington State tonight, 175 people have now died. 3,700 more are sick.
Governor Jay Inslee says he can only guess at how many more people will get the coronavirus.
The state is now writing up plans for the worst case scenario.
Don't call the woman in Michigan.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer officially calling on President Trump for a major disaster declaration in Michigan.
Michigan is now at more than 2,800.
With the spike of cases in Metro Detroit, hospitals are pleading for help.
Is what happens.
The governor of Washington.
No, you know what I say? If they don't treat you right, I don't call.
There has been reporting indicating concerns that the apportionment of these federal backstop supplies, whether from the strategic stockpile or not, are hinging on political considerations, maybe personal considerations about whether the president likes a governor or not. There's indications that states like Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Florida have gotten all their requests, while states like yours in Michigan and others have not. Are you concerned that the people in your state who are sick and maybe on the threshold of possibly dying or surviving are being punished for the politics you or the state have?
I hope not.
That seems kind of a weird way to do it, though, doesn't it? I mean, you competing with Governor Newsom of California, competing with Governor Cuomo of New York. I mean, that doesn't seem a very efficient way to, and not to mention thrifty way to get these supplies to the states as soon as possible.
That's correct. We're all competing against each other. This should have been a coordinated effort by the federal government and the National Defense Authorization that the president has to, you know, to essentially push this manufacturing really hasn't gone into effect in any way. And so, yes, we're competing against each other. We're competing against other countries. You know, it's a wild west, I would say, out there. And indeed, we're overpaying, I would say, for PPE because of that competition.
President Trump's in a battle with some governors accusing states of hoarding supplies.
There's a question as to hoarding of ventilators. Some hospitals and independent hospitals and some hospital chains, as we call them, they are holding ventilators. They don't want to let them up.
Hospitals, they're caring, they're comforting, they're hoarding. Did you know that hospitals hoard the majority of the world's stethoscope supply? And they always want more. Is that why their symbol is a plus sign? Even before their current ventilator obsession, hospitals have been accumulating enormous amounts of cotton balls, tongue depressors, even our urine. Just what do they need all that urine for? And don't bother trying to find a newborn baby. They're all in hospitals. Hospitals. If they're so great, then why is everyone there sick?
This is inspiring, too. If ever there was a living testament to believing in yourself, it is this president who somehow, even in the middle of a devastating public health crisis, still manages to find time to pay tribute to himself.
We have done an incredible job. We are doing a great job. I think for the most part, they were saying thank you for doing a great job. We're doing an awfully good job. Myself and the administration are doing a good job. Great job.
I'm doing a good job.
We're doing a great job.
We're doing a great job.
I think we're doing a really good job. I think we're doing a really good job. People like the job that we're doing. We're doing a good job. I think we're doing a great job on as good a job as you could possibly do.
If only his dad had said that once to him, maybe things would be different. Speaking of great jobs, today was the first day of work for Donald Trump's new chief of staff, Mark Meadows, which, can you think of any worse first day of work than in the Trump administration in the middle of a pandemic? I would rather be the assistant manager at Popeyes the day those chicken sandwiches came out. Mark Meadows was a congressman from North Carolina. He's one of Trump's most enthusiastic suck-ups. In fact, the only reason he agreed to take the job as chief of staff is because he found out First Lady was taken already. Meadows will be Trump's fourth chief of staff in 3 years, and we all know what the president thinks about instability like that. Three chief of staffs in less than 3 years of being president, part of the reason why Barack Obama can't manage to pass this agenda. But that was 2012. That was It was different.
Cases are now growing by tens of thousands nationwide every day. And even the sunniest voices in the administration that repeatedly played down the threat and looked into the camera to tell Americans that the risk was low, people like Vice President Mike Pence, they are now saying that we in the U.S. are on track similar to the hardest hit countries. Here's the Vice President, quote, "We think Italy may be most comparable areas to the United States at this point. Italy, where despite a national lockdown, hospitals are overwhelmed. Doctors, many of whom do not have sufficient medical equipment, are being forced to make decisions about who gets a chance to survive and who does not. It did not have to be like this. We did not have to have the worst outbreak in the world. The failure of this administration and this president to take the virus seriously is part of what got us to this point. State and local governments continue to do what they can in this fight because there continues to be not just an absence of federal leadership, but active, destructive incompetence. For example, the president has largely refused to invoke the Defense Production Act, which allows him to force businesses to manufacture items in an emergency. He refuses to do so or to standardize this manufacturing and take it over, despite large-scale shortages of life-saving ventilators and personal protective equipment. Well, it turns out the Defense Production Act isn't some break glass in case of emergency kind of thing that they haven't dealt with. It has been invoked hundreds of thousands of times in the Trump years. But with the pandemic, the president treats it as a break-the-glass last resort. And without a standardization of manufacturing, right now, I cannot stress this enough because I've been talking to people about this day and night the last few days. The market, there is a market right now to acquire ventilators and other equipment like masks and personal protective equipment that is totally and completely haywire. You have states being forced into bidding wars to get medical equipment and even having to bid against, oh, look, the federal government, which could have just taken control of the entire process from the start to coordinate this and avoid this insane situation. But they have not. And then there's this. The Pentagon, get this, the Pentagon has not yet delivered any of the 2,000 ventilators. 2,000 ventilators it offered to the Department of Health and Human Services 2 weeks ago. Because HHS has asked it to wait while the agency determines where the devices should go. Hospitals are desperate for ventilators. New York City mayor said we need 400 more in New York City in the next few days. People need them to live, and they are just sitting there. And even when the federal government does do something, when they do send ventilators, thousands of ventilators in the national stockpile do not work, according to a New York Times report. The reason? Listen to this. The reason. The contract to maintain the governor's stockpile lapsed late last summer, and a contracting dispute meant that a new firm did not begin its work until late July, when it was essentially too late. In perhaps the best illustration of this incompetence, Politico reported that last week, a Trump official was speaking to counterparts in Thailand in an effort to get protective gear, right? We need protective gear. They're trying to get protective gear for Thailand. Quote, the official asked the Thais for help, only to be informed by the puzzled voices on the other side of the line that a U.S. shipment of the same supplies, the second of two so far, was already on its way to Bangkok. We were sending them the things that we were asking for. Now, the administration has now frozen such aid, but exports by U.S. companies apparently continue. Listen to this. Roughly 280 million masks in U.S. warehouses were reportedly purchased by foreign buyers on Monday alone. And throughout this whole process, the president appears to be distributing that federal aid with an eye on his reelection prospects and not on need. Florida, where Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, a Trump ally, has finally issued a stay-at-home order after keeping the beaches open for spring break, has been getting all the emergency supplies the state requested, unlike other states. The Washington Post quoted a White House official who offered this explanation for why Trump is so attuned to Florida's wants. This is an official in the White House, okay? Quote, the president knows Florida is so important for his reelection.
We're the worst outbreak on earth. We've got not only more cases than any other country on earth now by far, but look at the trajectory of that curve. That's our death rate right now. And it is still headed almost straight up without any relief in sight. We are not getting this thing under control. And still, there are no national measures in place to try to slow the spread of it. I mean, in Italy, you can say what they're doing as a country. In Spain, you can say what they're doing as a country. In France, you can say what they're doing as a country. We're not doing anything as a country. The president was asked tonight why he didn't propose a national stay-at-home order. And he sort of riffed on the question and fiddled around with the question and ultimately landed on basically saying, well, in somewhere like Alaska, you wouldn't need it. That was the president's answer tonight for why there shouldn't be a national stay-at-home order. Take Alaska. You wouldn't need one there. You know what? They've already got over 130 cases in Alaska. And there is already a stay-at-home order in that state. Although the president apparently has no idea about that.
The White House Coronavirus Task Force will continue to take the posture that we will defer to state and local health authorities on any measures that they deem appropriate.
You do what you want. Well, can we defer? Florida isn't doing a stay-at-home order because we haven't told the governor to do one. Well, we're not really in the business of that kind of thing. So, you know, we defer whatever he's deferring to us. Well, we defer right back. So whatever, 20 million residents of Florida. It took an appearance on the Today Show this morning for the Surgeon General of the United States to, I think, perhaps inadvertently meander himself around to the idea that, yes, maybe there should be some federal direction on this key issue. Maybe.
There are guidelines that say that, look, the more we social distance, the more we stay at home, the less spread of disease there will be. My advice to America would be that these guidelines are a national stay-at-home order.
My advice to America would be that these guidelines are a national stay-at-home order? Wait, freeze frame there for a second. There's a national stay-at-home order now? Or it's just your advice? Or you're hoping that there would be one? You're calling for one? Or did you just issue one? We're the citizens of the nation with the worst coronavirus outbreak on Earth, where our death toll and our case numbers are skyrocketing out of control. As far as we know, there's no national policy in this country to try to slow that down.
Anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed. And everywhere, the ceremony of innocence is drowned. Donald Trump conducts a ceremony of innocence every day at the White House briefing, in which he has denied any responsibility for the failures of his administration's response to a pandemic that they knew was coming since the first week of January.
No, I don't take responsibility at all, because we were given a set of circumstances, and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time.
In his daily ceremony of innocence, Donald Trump pretends that he never said that the coronavirus was not going to be a very deadly pandemic in the United States. He pretends he never said this.
When you have 15 people, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero, that's a pretty good job we've done.
The Boston Globe has been recording every word Donald Trump has said about the coronavirus and everything Donald Trump has done and not done about the coronavirus. And the Globe's editorial board reached this conclusion. The months the administration wasted with prevarication about the threat and its subsequent missteps will amount to exponentially more COVID-19 cases than were necessary. In other words, the president has blood on his hands.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Tonight, I can report the sky is absolutely falling. We are all doomed. The end is near. The apocalypse is imminent, and you're going to all die. Or at least that's what the media mob would like you to think.
Yeah, I'm dead right on this. The coronavirus is the common cold, folks. The hype of this thing as a pandemic, as the Andromeda strain, as, oh my God, if you get it, you're dead.
This is one of those cases where the more I learn about coronavirus, the less concerned I am. There's a lot of hyperbole.
The national left-wing media playing up fears of the coronavirus.
The sky is falling because we have a few dozen cases of coronavirus on a cruise ship. I am far more concerned with stepping on a used heroin needle than I am getting the coronavirus, but maybe that's just me.
It's a virus like the flu.
Oh
all the talk about coronavirus being so much more deadly doesn't reflect reality.
This virus should be compared to the flu, because at worst, worst case scenario, it could be the flu.
The far more deadly, more lethal threat right now is not the coronavirus. It's the ordinary old flu. People are dying right now.
The flu is here.
Nobody has died yet in the United States, as far as we know, from this disease.
That's right.
And the facts are actually pretty reassuring, but you never know it watching all this stuff.
You want to know how I really feel about the coronavirus, Juan? If I get it, I'll beat it. I'm not afraid of the coronavirus, and no one else should be that afraid either.
It is very, very difficult to contract this virus.
It's milder than we thought. The fatality rate is going
to
drop.
So when you hear the context, it's not quite as scary.
It's actually the safest time to fly. Everyone I know that's flying right now, terminals are pretty much dead. And then the planes, remember back in the day when you had a seat next to you, possibly empty, you could stretch out a little more? Yeah. It's like that on every flight now.
One of the things you can do if you're healthy, you and your family, it's a great time to just go out, go to a local restaurant.
Yeah.
Likely you can get in easily.
Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz mocked concerns about the spread of the virus by wearing a gas mask on Capitol Hill.
When a reporter in the Capitol asked Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, 85, what precautions he was taking, he extended his arm with confidence. Want to shake hands?
In our line of work, you shake hands. I expect the president will continue to do that. I'll continue to do it.
We have contained this. We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight.
It is being contained. And do you not think it's being contained?
Zero people in the United States of America have died from the coronavirus. Zero.
This is a flu. This is like a flu. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. I took it very seriously.
By the way, this program has always taken the coronavirus seriously.
What is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on NYCLU's work with the legislature?
Well, it's honestly everything, Corinne. I don't think that's an exaggeration. It's everything from the basic human needs of having a civil liberties force that's now all working from home and remote, to the fact that some of our key issues, let's say, for example, bail reform and ensuring that doesn't get watered down, that's now a public health issue. So I think it has changed the urgency, the tenor, the priority of our issues and the way we do them. We're being as vigilant as we were, and perhaps more so, because in a time of a public health emergency, just like any emergency, we tend, unfortunately, at least here in the United States, to pass laws that shift the balance of power, that give the executive more authority. People are a little more forgiving about surveillance and shifts that could really erode our civil liberties. So I think we have a duty not just to keep up our work and still fight for all of those policy priorities, from transgender equity, LGBT rights, abortion access, to criminal justice and immigrants' rights. So they're everywhere. But we also, I think, now have this special duty as the kind of soul of New York civil liberties, to make sure that we don't give up liberty in this time that we'll come to regret later. We want to make it through this unbelievable period of time, an epidemic. We want to come through it with our lives and our liberty intact.
How has your work shifted during this time? In a normal year, NYCLU would be in the hallway talking to lawmakers as they're entering the room. How has your communication with lawmakers shifted?
Well, it's largely shifted to digital means. It's emails, it's video calls, occasionally a text. I hope everyone's respecting the open meeting law, because communications have really atomized. I don't actually just mean that flippantly. I think one change to how we're doing business, and this is true for everyone in the state, is it's a little less transparent. It's tougher to know exactly when a hearing's going to be or where. You don't see people physically walking to it from the hallways. You don't go and watch the Senate or Assembly chamber from above and get a sense of what's coming down the pike. We have the benefit of being an old institution. We've been in Albany for many years, and we have relationships, we have allies, we have coalitions, we have a statewide presence. So we have this mechanism that allows us to monitor. So some of those mechanics look like they would have looked in the before time, but the reality is that the communication with the legislators is tougher. We already have a fairly non-transparent legislative process in New York. Having lobbied in other states, I feel confident saying that. And the pandemic has made it even less transparent. We can all recognize that's a loss for democracy. The best policies happen with the most sunlight. And one unfortunate consequence of this epidemic is the legislature is caught up at its busiest time when many of them are scared to kind of even be in the building.
Does NYCLU have any concerns about the process adopted by the legislature passing this year's budget in terms of constitutionality, the fact that lawmakers may not have been in a room together? Are there any constitutional concerns?
Well, look, I think we're made of constitutional concerns. That's our job, to be paranoid government watchdogs every day. I'll back up a little bit to the kind of very beginning of the power shifting because of COVID-19. And that was when the legislature, although all physically present and convened in Albany, this is kind of before business turned to everything but usual, were handed a $40 million appropriations bill, I think around 11:30 p.m. It was around that time, certainly very late. Attached to that appropriations bill was a massive sea change in the governor's executive power. And this effectively consolidated his executive order authority into a pretty much a free-floating ability to enact and strike down laws as he sees fit after the declaration of an emergency. And of course, Cuomo knew that he would be using these powers in very short order with the looming threat of COVID. At that moment in time, business was still pretty usual in Albany. Again, everyone was there. Rather than provide that bill, allow the public and the press to see it, and vote on it in the light of day, the legislature was, you know, look, they're not only adults, they're our representatives, so I shouldn't undermine their choice here. But they were clearly very pressured and felt strong-armed into voting a fairly immense amount of their power away in the very wee hours of the morning. And I was there, you know, watching in the gallery, and it was dismaying. I mean, there were folks who got up on the floor and rightly said, I don't know if what we're doing gives the governor a ton of new powers or is basically procedural and he could kind of do this, but I would like to know the answers to those questions and I don't understand why we're doing this now. But of course, this power was attached to a $40 million appropriation that everyone knew we needed for public health and was absolutely proper to do on an emergency basis. It was just the kind of shift of the power from the legislature to the governor that we felt was unseemly to do at midnight, right, with no one watching when they could have absolutely done it the next day. So I think that's the kind of thing it's our job to be vigilant about. And sometimes the answers aren't really sexy enough for a lot of mainstream media. But the truth is this, Corinne, we have lots of concerns. I think the potential for that power to be abused is real. Legislatures, including the New York State legislature, have a bad history of giving too much power, I think, to the executive and giving their own power up in the wake of an emergency. They certainly did so after 9/11. And it becomes really hard to push back, right, in times of pain and panic to say, no, these values are here for a reason and we're really going to want them when we come out of this. I would say that it's our job to be concerned about process. It doesn't always get a headline, but I would also add that I'm not sure anything we've seen on the state level has been a substantive violation of civil liberties that stands out to me as obviously unconstitutional or gravely concerning. But I think it's important to say that just because we're not screaming from the rooftops that someone's rights have been violated doesn't mean that we need to watch, be careful, be present, be vigilant for any time we're using the cloak of an emergency to justify a fundamental shift of power between the branches of government. But I think the silver lining of that is that the application of these rules, and look, I give Cuomo credit, has largely been driven by public health concerns, has itself been transparent. Unfortunately, that resolution expires. So it's not a permanent change. And that's exactly the kind of thing I think we want to ensure happens, is that if we do restrict our liberties in ways we would not otherwise tolerate. For example, right, quarantines. You do it only for as long as is necessary to grapple with the problem, and the government must give you a really good reason as to why it's restricting your liberty, and that reason has to be based on facts, science, and public health. And I think that is probably the biggest theme for how we as civil libertarians, you know, hold in our hearts as we look at everything that's going on, whether it's a theoretical power shift or an actual application of new rules to protect public health. And we're thinking, does the government have to do this? And if it has to do it, can it do it for as short a time of period as possible, ensure that people can object if they feel their rights are being violated, and are they being driven by public health guidelines? And I think, as a general matter, I'm comfortable saying in New York, the answer has been yes to all three, but that doesn't diminish the need for us to continue to watch and be critical.
So you'd give Governor Cuomo an A+, it sounds like, for handling this crisis, but maybe a C- in terms of process.
I'm not sure I can be objective enough to hand out those grades, although I am a natural school marm at heart.
Hi, I'm Rachel T.
Hi, I'm Eva.
Hi, I'm Rachel G.
We are all Girl Scouts, and this is WGXC ACRA.
Hay acciones cotidianas para ayudar a prevenir la propagación de enfermedades respiratorias. Lávese las manos. Evite el contacto cercano con las personas enfermas. Evite tocarse los ojos, la nariz y la boca. Quédese en casa cuando esté enfermo. Cúbrase al toser o estornudar. Limpie y desinfecte de manera frecuente los objetos que toca. Para obtener más información, visite cdc.gov/COVID-19. Este mensaje es gentileza de la National Association of Broadcasters y de esta estación.
Wave Farm programs are made possible, in part, by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Adelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Cruel and Unusual Punishment, the U.S. Prison Pandemic. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Podcasting today from the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, New York City. Stay at home, shelter in place, maintain social distance. We now know how to stop the COVID-19 pandemic. Containment of the novel coronavirus requires we act together as a global community. But not everyone has the freedom to take these steps. The United States is the greatest jailer in the world, with over 2.3 million people in detention. In this sprawling, fragmented gulag, the coronavirus runs rampant, rips through jailed populations, and crosses prison walls with every shift change when the guards and staff enter and leave. New York City has become the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States. And Rikers Island, New York's notorious jail, is a cauldron of infection. Both prisoners and staffers describe a filthy, unsanitary jail with limited cleaning supplies, virtually no PPE, that's personal protective equipment, and cramped spaces with no way to maintain safe distance from others. The one ward equipped to handle infectious diseases is full. Recent reports indicate 180 prisoners, 114 guards, and 23 healthcare workers have tested positive for COVID-19. The actual number is undoubtedly far higher due to the egregious lack of testing almost everywhere in the United States. Dr. Ross McDonald, the top doctor at Rikers Island, called the situation there a public health disaster unfolding before our eyes. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has ordered a limited release of prisoners from Rikers, some over the age of 70, some with pre-existing conditions, two groups for whom COVID-19 is especially lethal. That still leaves close to 5,000 people in New York City's jail system, primarily on Rikers. New York's Legal Aid Society compiled COVID-19 infection rates in New York City jails with stark findings. They calculated an infection rate of 3.91%, 8 times higher than New York City and more than 9 times higher than the hard-hit Lombardy region in Italy. Tina Luong, the lead attorney in Legal Aid's criminal defense practice, said in a statement, "Stop sending people to Rikers and let these New Yorkers out immediately. Anything else is too little, too late," she said. There's one way that Rikers prisoners can access protective gear, however. The Intercept has reported they're being offered $6 per hour along with PPE if they agree to dig mass graves at New York City's public cemetery on Hart Island.
The story of Rikers is the story of all 5,000 jails and prisons and ICE detention centers around the country. The top priority is release. We must get people out of these places, particularly those with health risks for serious injury and death.
That's Dr. Homer Venters, former chief medical officer for New York City's Correctional Health Services, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour last week.
We also have to make sure that the people who are still behind bars have access today to hospital-level care when they become sick. We have to avoid the temptation to use lockdown as a public health intervention. It's not.
But a lockdown is precisely what the Federal Bureau of Prisons imposed on April 1st, confining all 176,000 federal prisoners around the country to their cells for at least 2 weeks. Then there's the immigration detention system. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, detains over 39,000 people. On Monday, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus added their voice to over 3,000 medical professionals and many immigrant rights groups calling on ICE to release the vast majority of detainees.
The immigration detention centers really are vulnerable to the outbreak of a contagious disease.
That's John Sandwig, former acting director of ICE in the Obama administration, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour recently.
It's really impossible to engage in the social distancing that we're all practicing right now. So when you look at the population of ICE who's in those detention facilities, and you recognize that really only a small percentage pose any public safety threat, when you recognize that their immigration proceedings can continue, even if they're out of custody, and when you look at the thousands of ICE officers, contract guards, and employees who have to go to those facilities every day, who frankly are just as much at risk of catching COVID-19 because of their exposure to the facilities themselves, it seems just very commonsensical to me to say, let's go ahead and downsize the population of the detention centers dramatically, release these individuals.
ICE itself, without President Donald Trump's approval or any court order, has the unilateral authority to release its prisoners. The Prison Policy Initiative, known as PPI, in a comprehensive report released last week, lists the complex web of incarceration now holding 2.3 million people in the United States, 1,833 state prisons, 110 federal prisons, 1,772 juvenile correctional facilities, 3,134 local jails, 218 immigration detention facilities, 80 Indian country jails, military prisons, civil commitment centers, state psychiatric hospitals, and prisons in U.S. territories, unquote. They report that 75% of people locked up in local jails, including Rikers, are not convicted of any crime, but are simply jailed awaiting trial because they cannot afford bail. The Prison Policy Initiative also reports that 200,000 enter the system weekly and as many leave. Flattening the curve of the COVID-19 pandemic will only happen through massive collective action. President Donald Trump, all 50 state governors and local authorities need to release as many of their prisoners as possible quickly. But that will take public pressure from us all. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes?
Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
You sound a little taller on radio.
Thank you.
I hear the crystal raindrops fall on the window down the hall, and it becomes the morning dew. And darling, when the morning comes and I see the morning sun, I want to be the one with you. Just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Just the two of us.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away. Wonder this time where she's gone. She's gone.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're talking with Brian O'Malley, who is the executive director of the Consumer Directed Personal Assistance Association of New York State. He's also a member of Medicaid Matters New York. Brian, can you tell us a little bit about what is the Consumer Directed Personal Assistance Association of New York State?
Sure, Mark, and thank you for having me on. Consumer Directed Personal Assistance Association of New York State, or CDPANES, is an organization that works to advance the interests of consumer-directed personal assistance program. We represent the consumers and the providers within this program to advance self-direction within the community-based long-term care area, primarily the world of home care. Except in our world, instead of having a home care agency send somebody to your house, the end user, the consumer, is actually doing that recruitment, doing that hiring, and is in charge of who is coming into their homes, who is providing those services. And it can even, in some instances, be family members, adult children, brothers, sisters, and the like.
Now, isn't it true these days that Medicaid picks up a significant portion of the cost of long-term care?
Medicaid is realistically the only payer of community-based long-term care for a large chunk of the population. Private pay home care, private pay nursing homes are not something that is within the reach of the majority of the population, at least not for an extended period of time. So when it comes to long-term care, Medicaid is the primary payer. And when it comes to our program, Consumer Direction, Medicaid is the only payer because we only exist within the world of Medicaid.
Now, this year, even before the coronavirus hit and crashed the economy, you know, the New York State was facing, somewhere about a $6 billion deficit. The governor sought to cut several billion dollars out of the Medicaid program through this Medicaid redesign team. What were some of the key Medicaid issues going into this, budget session?
I think in many respects, it was the governor identified what he viewed as overspending within the long-term care sphere of Medicaid. It's not a secret that long-term care costs a lot of money. It is a service that is in many cases provided daily. On an hourly basis. It's not a discrete service like a doctor's visit or something along those lines. And it is provided for years and years and years. Even a nursing home, the average lifespan of somebody who goes into a nursing home is 6 months. So it costs a lot of money. However, it is paid out over a very short period of time in most instances. For somebody in long-term care and community-based, that is a much longer period of time. So he was targeting this area, which is growing rapidly because we have a rapidly aging population. And he was targeting other areas that were growing, mainly on the community-based public health care side.
Now, what did, say, the long-term care community, particularly, your organization, feel about some of the proposals that he was making? Was it, designed to improve the quality of life for the consumers you represented, or is it more or less just try to squeeze the system to cut payments and, somehow force, cutbacks across the board?
The system was designed to force cutbacks across the board and target the populations that were being identified as driving up costs. At C.D. Paney's, we actually worked with our consumers and identified several areas that were actually just bureaucratic sticking points that weren't necessary.
How did your group feel about, you know, some of the cuts that the governor ended up, you know, making? Was it really, you know, trying to help the quality of life for, you know, consumers with long-term care needs?
Some credit where it's due. We had identified about a number of efficiencies that can reduce the bureaucracy and save money by improving consumers' lives. And some of those were included. But you can't say that, you know, these small number of efficiencies outweigh the $2.5 billion that are overwhelmingly negative.
So how do you feel with the resolution and the budget? Maybe you could explain that a little bit. I know there was concern raised by the governor wanted to put in his $2 billion worth of cut, but that clashed somewhat with the $6 billion bailout from the federal government, which did basically would prohibit cuts. How did that get resolved?
You know, that's in many ways we are very glad that finally common sense prevailed and we at least took the $6.7 billion that the federal government was offering us. That was a positive development. I think it speaks volume to this entire process that the bulk of the debate was, do we accept $6.7 billion or do we turn it down so that we can immediately act, so that we can immediately enact $2.5 billion in cuts on healthcare for poor people and disabled people. The fact that that was the bulk of the conversation is mind-boggling to me. But we are glad that they at least did push off some of these actions until after the requirements at the federal level are done. And
unfortunately, our internet connection didn't allow us to continue the interview. But overall, lawmakers approved the Medicaid cuts pushed by the governor, but they'll phase them in after the coronavirus crisis passes. This delay will allow the state to access the $6 billion in additional federal funding for Medicaid. Eventually, there'll be near